from Portland, Oregon, or APA Compass Radio, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Find podcasts of our program at apacompass.wordpress.com or contact us on Facebook. Thanks for listening to APA Compass Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. I am Willis Van Dusen, the mayor of Astoria. Yay! And this is a wonderful celebration. It is such an honor to represent the community for this event. And I'd like to welcome you all home. This is the home. 100 years ago, a very historic event happened in Astoria, and we're going to celebrate that this weekend.
Thanks for tuning in to APA Compass. I'm Sari Gametta. You just heard remarks from the opening reception of the Gother Party Centennial Celebration last month in Astoria, Oregon. Until quite recently, most Oregonians were unaware that there was a community of Punjabi laborers living and thriving in the early 1900s. Additionally, this community included the Indian nationalist Gother Party, the initial seeds to the Indian independence movement. So how did all of this come to light? Joe Ogden, local historian, unearthed this history in her publication, Gother, Historical Silences and Notions of Belonging, Early 1900s Punjabis of the Columbia River. She then made sure the City Council of Astoria was aware that this was the 100-year anniversary of the Gother Party's formation in their city. Her work also awarded her the 2013 Joel Palmer Award, granted by the Oregon Historical Society. Joe Ogden always had an interest in community histories, but most of the motivation behind her work stems from belonging and citizenship. Specifically, the events surrounding September 11th inspired much of her research and led her to the Gother Party. She joined me at KBOO to chat about this journey and this little-known history that led to the centennial celebration in Astoria last month.
But this one was really motivated by 9/11, and it was in the sense that I'm certainly wasn't alone in this, but when I saw those towers get hit, you knew no good was going to come out of it in terms of the response of this country to it, both internationally and domestically. And, you know, my mother grew up in L.A., and she grew up in a largely Japanese community, and she went from going to school with people to suddenly those same people were considered enemies. And that's the question I wanted to think about. How does that happen? And I was looking for a story to find a way to talk about those issues, how you go from being a part of, how the other gets delineated, basically, how it gets defined.
And how did this lead specifically to the area of early Punjabi immigration?
Stumbles is really kind of the word I use. When I started looking for a way to talk about post 9/11 issues, just to make a long story short, ended up meeting Cambiz Ganay Basiri, who's a professor at Reed College. And he did a small collection of Arab American interviews in this state. And he was nice enough to let me go ramble to him one afternoon about my concerns and what kind of things I was looking to do. And he was very quiet through most of that hour and said to me, well, if I were you, I would look at Punjabi migrants to the area and the Gother Party. And that sort of is what got me on the trail. You know, I found some photos here in the state of men working on the railroad in southern Oregon with turbans on, and that about knocked me out of my chair. And then one thing led to another, and I ended up in Astoria and spent quite a long time over various months going through newspapers and started finding this history of, I didn't understand altogether what I was seeing in the beginning, and then found some secondary sources by Dr. Puri in India that in a couple of pages written in early 1970s sort of put the light bulb on as far as what I was seeing. So it's like all history, it's a collective project, you know, nobody does it alone.
Before we go further, I think we should probably explain the Gother Party and why this is an important subject so that we have some context.
Okay. So my research is about early, and by early I mean 1905 to about 1915. It's pretty specific Punjabi and largely Sikh community that lived here in Oregon, predominantly from the Dalles to Astoria, the largest community of them, roughly about 100, mainly men, one family lived in Astoria. Again, largely Sikh, but also included Muslims and Hindus. And in about 1913, they, as a part of the Punjabi community that existed from British Columbia to the Mexican-California border, in response to both the sort of restrictions that were on them for migration, jobs, racial violence, all of those things, they became a fairly politically restive community. And sort of radicalism developed around that, largely the center of that in British Columbia. But eventually it coalesced into a political party, and that party's name is the Gutter Party. And it's considered sort of the beginning of what is now known as the Indian Independence Movement. So it was a radical nationalist party. Again, sort of the heart of my research, I guess you'd say, is that that party has long been thought to have begun in California, which is where its headquarters ended up in San Francisco and had lots of support amongst the Punjabi and Sikh settlement in the Central Valley there. But I'm arguing that it actually crystallized in Astoria in 1913 and held its meeting in the Finnish Socialist Hall there and went on to be a global movement with a newspaper and included people in the Philippines, all over the world. And basically their political strategy was, A of all, it was religiously inclusive. So it was Sikh, Hindu, Muslim. Their attitude was it was a secular group, so check your religion at the door. But what our religion is to overthrow the British colonialists. And they used World War I as their opening to do that.
And you touched upon this, that the headquarters were in San Francisco.
Correct.
Is that the reason that history was erased in Oregon? Is it because of the headquarters, or why was this the case?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really complicated question and a really good question. I think it's several things. And so I think the headquarters and the fact that the newspaper that they produced was there in San Francisco, that became its sort of notorious center. And a lot of the propagandists that were associated, the writers for the paper, the organizers, lived, congregated, worked there, certainly. I think it also has to do with there's been a continuous community of Punjabis and Sikhs throughout California, largely through the Central Valley. So there's a solid tie to that history here. And so I think the fact that this story disappeared, and we can talk about some of the reasons for that in Oregon.
Beyond the party, the entire community's presence, which was living and thriving here in Oregon, Washington, Vancouver, that you had said that there were newspaper accounts of news bulletins of events. So obviously there was a documented presence, and
right.
Yet.
Yeah, and that's actually the piece in some ways that's the most interesting to me is, and I think it should be puzzling to other people and should give us pause for today too. And I should say, and I'm going to circle back, but I should say that what interests me here is that I think how we tell the stories of our past really shape how we think and act in our present. So that's my interest here. This is a fascinating story, but I think if your story is just that Oregon's all shaped by the Oregon, you know, Lewis and Clark, the Oregon Trail, that really affects how you see today about who you think belongs, who forms your community. And part of what this story does, besides just being, again, people doing amazing things and it complicating our history, is it really complicates, it should, who we think about and who's here and who's a part of making us today.
It complicates our presence. So what are the implications of an entire community's presence being essentially erased from history?
Yeah, and again, I think that's one of the most interesting pieces of this puzzle, and there have been a lot of interesting pieces. First, I should say, when I started discovering this story, and then I realized that none of us presently knew anything about it, what I assumed was going to fill that gap would be racial violence, would be mobs, riots, people driven out, which if you consider the Chinese presence, you know, that's a lot of what happened all over the West Coast. If you consider the Punjabi and Sikh presence, that's what happened, for example, in Washington and Bellingham, terrible riots and people.
1907.
Yeah, right. In 1907, exactly. And I think, and those riots, 1907 in Bellingham and a few, and on Labor Day of all things, and a few days later in British Columbia, similar riot. And it was actually in response to those riots that I think people started coming to Oregon. But I found that it wasn't racial violence, but it's a very complicated racial policy that exists in this state. And I think it comes down to this. It comes down to early founders of the state and early, you know, the editor of the Oregonian, one of the mayors, one of the governors, they took the stand of like, look, they looked up and down the West Coast, they saw the Chinese getting driven out, and then you can go down the litany of other people after the Chinese that mm-hmm. had similar violence perpetrated against them. And they said, these people are getting driven out. We need laborers. This is like perfect for us. So they took a stand against that kind of overt racial violence. It wasn't because they were inclusive in their vision. I think the policy was, we're not going to allow racial violence because then people will come here, we'll be able to use their labor. We won't allow them to be citizens. We won't allow them to vote. We won't allow them to own property, but we'll get all the benefits. So on one side, they were saying, yeah, come on. And on the other side, they were telling the sort of solid population of Oregon that they considered to be the solid piece, they're not going to stay. It's okay. They're just coming to work and then they'll go away, right? But I do think that this racial policy of Oregon had everything to do with the social assumptions behind it and how it sort of floats into everybody's head and seeps into the pores. That's ultimately why this story got erased. Because you know, part of what I talk about in that article is that, you know, I looked through all sorts of records and you'd see things where, like in police records of jailings, they would contrast American with Negro or Jew. So they would say they had arrested Americans and then they'd had arrested a Negro and a Jew. And as far as I last checked, those people were considered part of this country. But that's the social erasure that goes on. And I think when you talked about when people talked about who were the pioneers and founders in a town, anybody with the last name Singh was not included, you know? So that's ultimately how this story got erased, was just through social assumption. It wasn't through racial violence. It wasn't through some overt keep those people out. It was the much quieter and more insidious, in my opinion, version of those things. And I think people, this was a relatively small community, and some people might argue, well, no big deal. But if you look at the richness, especially in places like Astoria, of the kinds of ways that they appeared in the press, people were talking about people getting sick and burials and the fact that Hindus and Punjabis and Sikhs were involved in major mill strikes. They were well known in their community. You know, they had big front page articles about quote unquote Hindu wrestlers, which at the time referred to Hindustan, not the religion, mm-hmm. is what was being referred to. You know, so communities were rooting across racial lines, in other words. So they existed, and I'm not by any way saying it was a mecca, but I'm saying people were not unaware they were here by any stretch of the imagination. So that question of the erasure is really interesting, how it gets lost.
We don't have a violence to point to, except for the 1907 riots. We don't have a movement or anything that points to why this happened, and that actually does mark the history of this community.
Right.
It just faded out of the minds of people.
I do need to say that it wasn't as if the state was without violence against Punjabis and Sikhs. There was the 1910 St. John's riot that happened, and The thing that I think is interesting, that one, if you contrast it to Billingham, is the response of the district attorneys, that they came after it with grand juries, they arrested large numbers of people. It was a typical thing that it ultimately came down to only one person being convicted, and the lowliest, the mayor, the fire marshal, the policeman didn't get convicted. It was the foreman of, you know, one of the mill workers that got convicted. That said, nonetheless, I'm not by any stretch saying there wasn't violence here. It was not on the scale, and it was dealt with, I think, differently than in other places. And this, again, came from that policy. But, you know, I think the insidiousness of it continues. And I think you took the words out of my mouth. The fact that you can't point to an event and say, that's the reason that people aren't included anymore today, instead of this more undercurrent of assumption about who belongs here and who doesn't.
I want to thank everyone for coming, and I want to thank the city for really taking this and running with it. It's just unprecedented, and it wouldn't happen without you guys.
Thank you very much. But we're very serious. This isn't the gutter party and the guests here and the city of Astoria. We're all one. I mean, this happened. This is our history, it's your history, it's United States history, and obviously it's history in India also, but it's, don't feel like guests, welcome home. We're very serious about that.
You're listening to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is an interview with community historian Jo Ogden and her research on the early Punjabi laborers in Oregon.
Talking about history and archiving records, you mentioned the scholar says there's what happened and what is said to have happened.
Yes.
And I find this really interesting in the work of historians. How do you reconcile these two accounts?
Well, because I think ultimately it comes down to humans are just storytelling machines. That's what we are, right? I mean, and as much as histories sometimes like to claim about its objective and just the facts, ma'am, it's, you know, I don't buy it. And a lot of other historians don't buy it either. You know, more importantly, a lot of other historians. And, you know, history isn't just a list of facts. We don't just make lists. We put them together into a story. And there's no time that we can step outside of our beliefs. So our beliefs and our thinking stitches together those facts. And that's what I think this Trujillo, the Haitian historian, has so brilliantly talked about, and I really encourage people to read his work, is, you know, when it gets interesting is when you start looking at that difference between what happened and what we say happened, because that's where it gets juicy and dicey, and you actually start learning some things, you know, which was his point.
How did you collect your research for this?
Yeah, because there's no continuous community, or I shouldn't say that. It's extraordinarily scant. There are a couple of descendants that I know, and I have spoken to people, but for the most part, it's a disconnected community between people who came here later, the 80s, 90s, et cetera, right? So mainly what I did was, you know, for me, history is just like a big scavenger hunt for adults, right? And this one in particular, I just sort of took a comb to the records from Astoria to the Dalles. So I went through pretty much in every town, and I learned some things about communities I didn't even know existed, like one south of Hood River called Winans that is basically a whistle stop out in the woods, and had a meeting of 100 men for the gutter party to organize for it, which is just, if you ever go out there, it's kind of mind-boggling to think about, because they were basically sitting out in the woods and planning to overthrow the British. So it's a crazy story, right? I mean, They literally, these people were, you know, they collected money, they put out a paper, they were going to rent a boat, fill it up with guns, drive it home, and overthrow the British while they were occupied with the Germans during World War I. That was, gutter means mutiny. It also means revolution. It translates both ways. And a lot of the mutiny part refers to the fact that a lot of these men were ex-military men, because the Sikhs were a very predominant part of the British colonial, both military force and police force.
Well, what I was getting to was that to kind of write the history of someone else's community is a very careful and sensitive thing to to take on. So what are some of the challenges that you faced?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing, I would have voted me least likely to write this history. So, but sometimes you just find yourself doing something. So then you're either faced with a choice of not doing it because you're not of that community, or just trying to do the best job that you can with it. And I had a lot of people help me so that I, you know, both members of that community today, scholars from that community, people that aren't South Asian but are also scholars of that community. So I sought out a lot of help. And, you know, you just, and I vetted it a lot. That's the other thing, amongst people. So, you know, and I'd love to make this a more collective project, and I have some thoughts about doing that, and I'm talking to people about doing that. Besides in general, that I think history is better when it's done that way, is that I think this history belongs to a community. So that's where it should go.
In a complicated story that has, until now, been unaccounted for, what does it mean to belong?
Yeah. So what does it mean, for example? I mean, I guess the words that sort of echo in my head a lot these days are, go home. Like, what the hell? What does that mean? Go home. And it doesn't reflect the complexity of, or the complexion, if you want to get that down to it, of what this area, what North America has been from the get-go. You know, first from the indigenous peoples, then, you know, you're talking about African chattel slaves, you're talking about massive labor from every single part of the world. And especially in the West, you have to talk about the peoples from China, Hindustan, Japan, the Philippines. That is part and parcel of why this place looks like it does today. And we need to complicate our stories much more than the narration that goes. And so that's what I think. And I think it does ultimately come down to why you can say something as stupid as go home, you know? Come on. So one of the things that's happened with this article, but also the fact that the city of Astoria has done a fairly amazing thing, I think. And so after I published this article, I wrote to the city of Astoria and said, you know, I really think you should know that this happened in your city, and this year is the 100-year anniversary. And, you know, celebrations literally are going on all over the world, and this is kind of the ground zero. And within less than a month, they had stepped up. So they issued a proclamation upholding the history, upholding and celebrating that city's connection to that party, but most especially the people behind it. And this is the first time this has happened outside of India, which is, I really want to commend the city for doing the right thing, and doing not just the right thing, but a pretty amazing thing. And they took it another step and called for and are funding a 100-year commemoration of the formation of the Gutter Party in their town. And people are coming from all over the West Coast to attend this. And one of the things that proclamation has done is it's literally traveled the globe, and people have picked it up and are using it. For example, I know there's a coalition of people of Sikh temples in Central California that's taking it to mayors through the Central Valley to get them to do the right thing also.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes. And that coalition has also been involved in getting Sikh history in the state included in the statewide curriculum, because I think you raised the very important point about if you don't know these things, it's just going to continue.
Going back to the commemoration, what do you hope attendees will take away from that event?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and maybe I haven't thought about it enough. I think my mission here is I just want people to have a much more complicated notion of how they think about Oregon history and generally North American history. So I think that's the biggest takeaway for me. And I have to say, when, and I don't want the story lost, this is also a story of, which I do think is really relevant for our times. People think about the kind of emotional and psychic leap it takes to go from people planning, a lot of the records I've found were people planning to stay, people buying land out in the Dalles, thinking they were going to farm, people filing declarations of intention, which were the first step in becoming citizens, people getting married, people doing all those kinds of things that, and if you look at Washington or British Columbia or California, there was much more of that, people building temples, people building businesses, doing all of those things. Those are all intentions of staying and making this home. And yet within a few short years' time, because this is very telescoped history, for the most part, this migration occurred between 1905 and people left around 1914 and 15 with the outbreak of the war. Yeah, it's 10 years. Yeah. And you're talking about going from seeing people trying to become citizens in Canada or here and wanting the right to vote to saying, nope, I'm packing it up. I'm putting my life on the line and I'm going back home to make change. You know, we can't get into all the ins and outs of what make a movement and what makes people make those sort of decisions. But those are amazing leaps for people to make. And so part of what I want people to know is this is just another one of those really rich stories about people doing amazing things. And a lot of it had to do with radicalism. And we need to say that because part of the reason that I think this happened in Astoria is because Finnish socialists had a lot of sway there. And they, the socialists, the wobblies, those kinds of people were the ones who rejected a lot of the narrow white supremacy that was going on at the time. And they sought the equality of nations, that people should have the right to self-rule. The importance of radicalism has to be emphasized here is that not you don't have to go along with the program, and what action you take literally affects history, you know? And that's what happened here. That's really the story. And that's, for me and my sensibilities, I think is a story, a very relevant story for our times about what we do and rejecting the petty, narrow nationalist bullshit around us makes a difference.
So thank you so much, Joe Ogden, for chatting with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for the very important work that you do.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was community historian Joe Ogden, winner of the 2013 Joel Palmer Award for her research on early Punjabi laborers in Oregon and their link to the Indian independence movement. You can read her publication at the Oregon Historical Society website, ohs.org. I'm Sari Gametha, and you're listening to APA Compass.